As Ukraine and Russia fell into war, I had some questions about what it meant for cybersecurity. John Murchison, CEO of Blackpoint Cyber, to answer those questions. This is a bonus episode of The Business of Tech. Well, John, thanks for joining me. I'm going to dive right in because I wanted to bring somebody on from the security space to talk to me a little bit about the current situation related to Ukraine and Russia. It's all on all of our minds. And from a cyber perspective, I think most of us in IT services are looking going like, well, it feels like attacks are going a little lower because they're focused on one another. Hey, what are the experts seeing? What do you see?
Yeah. So, you know, this is a really big topic. As you know, as soon as this popped off, it was like instant security theater from every marketing department. Like the, you know, world's going to come down. Like we internally recorded a private video, not for public consumption, on our thoughts to our customer base. And here's like the uncut, just pragmatic take. You know, we have seen zero increase in volume or sophistication of attacks, either from nation states or ransomware groups. Now, when we talk the MSP space, I would say ransomware is 95% of what we're stopping on pretty much a daily basis. Nation states are more like 2%, just because the typical customer in MSP, you know, serves, unless it's like a regional utility or some small boutique manufacturer on a critical supply chain for, you know, a defense or aircraft or whatever, you just don't see it a lot. And then I caveat it with that being said, it is plausible to think that maybe the Russian-based ransomware groups could feel more empowered to, you know, kind of increase their operations. But then right at the same time, you know, Conti had some issues. You know, Conti is obviously one of the biggest Russian-based ransomware syndicates. And like all these syndicates, they have folks from all different countries. And I don't know if they had Ukrainian guys in the game or not, but they promptly had some pretty massive leaks that, you know, has caused different trade for us to see different trade craft. So I think, you know, big picture, it's a good reminder to like button up on the fundamentals. When nation states go to war, you must assume the nation state assets, you know, coalesce to focus on that topic, and they can't take on everyone at once. So they have a lot of things going on. They're getting bogged down, obviously, in the conventional military side. You know, they have vigilante cyber groups going after them that can't be, you know, that's got to eat up some of their defensive capabilities. And I would think their offensive guys are still primarily focused on Ukraine. That's not to say there isn't a threat here in the United States, that we shouldn't be prepared. We should. But I think, you know, I think you're really looking more at like banking, big manufacturers, logistics, you know, and then critical infrastructure. I don't know where that magic red line is, because this has never really happened, like full scale nation state and nation state warfare. I have to think there's a red line, but I have to think the bar would be a little bit lower for like regional municipalities. We see a lot of combined networks, right? So, so big picture, we haven't seen anything yet, but we're damn prepared if we do.
So is that the extent, do you think, of the collateral damage? Do you think there's collateral damage we need to be thinking about in this conflict?
Yeah. I mean, I think the collateral damage will happen if, you know, offensive actions are taken against, you know, Western countries that like where it's like this is clearly a nation state, not just like a criminal syndicate or something like that. You know, the only area I would say, like, and I haven't seen it happen, or I don't know enough like deep in the weeds technical details. I have read that there have been, and I have no inside info, that there have been some attacks on Ukrainian ISP internet infrastructure. That has always been my greatest concern. You know, utilities and SCADA attacks and all this stuff get all, and banks get all the press. But, you know, the reality is SCADA attacks are still pretty hard to pull off. And when you look at the one the Russians did against the Ukrainians a bunch of years ago, you know, did it shock everyone? Yes. It took the power out for about 230,000 people for like 6-12 hours. But there's actually no SCADA protocol or PLC attack in that. It was actually more live off the land, literally open the breaker type attack and destroy everything on the way out. And frankly, we have thunderstorms like in the spring and summer that do way worse here all the time. So those are really hard. I worry much more about routing and switching infrastructure at the core. That is the glue that everyone sleeps on. That is by far, in my opinion, the most critical infrastructure when it comes to internet comms, because it just has cascading effects everywhere.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you then to take out your crystal ball, right? And the typical caveats on this, it's crystal ball, it's cracked and it's foggy. So we know it's...
So I'm just going to make it up.
Right. So we know it's not great. Talk to me about how you think this might play out. And maybe we'll do sort of two scenarios to give you a little sense. Like, what's kind of the worst way this might play out cyber-wise, and what we would be hoping for, like on the good end of the spectrum?
I mean, yeah, I think worst way this plays out on the cyber side is, there's large scale attacks against internet communications infrastructure, media infrastructure, banking, manufacturing, and logistics. That being said, having kind of come from the intelligence community world, I also think that's really hard to pull off and time it right. Like, these things just don't work. Like, there's not physics involved quite the same as launching a missile and it hits target. Right. There's, you fail way more than you ever win, and achieving effect with timing that achieves the ultimate like mission goal, it's quite difficult, and it requires a lot of things to go your way. And I also can't imagine doing it while being attacked at the same time. I think it would actually be quite difficult. So I think on the worst case scenario, they just decide to go all in on cyber warfare. But I got to be honest, I think if that happens, like, this is escalating to a whole nother ballgame. We, to be candid, cyber's like the least of our worries. I'd be worried about, I worry much, much more, to be candid, way less about the cyber side. I worry way more on this going something past conventional or something where our satellite infrastructure.
I want to just sort of do a double check. I think the answer is like the standard sort of best practices, but I want to double check it. Yeah. Like, from a typical IT services company serving, a collection of customers, are the recommendations essentially the, like, just continue good best practices, or is there something unique to this situation?
No. I think there's more, but I don't think it's unique to like Russia and Ukraine. I think it's unique to the threat of an attack on your continuity of operations, whether it's ransomware or data theft, where they're holding you hostage, or a destructive attack like the wiper stuff we see. So industry best practices mostly, to me, focus on reducing your attack surface. So, the way we like to look at it, and it's kind of riff of a nice model called the cyber defense matrix that Sunil, you made, but we take a step back and you look at any infrastructure, and this is taking compliance out of it because I consider that mostly checkbox security.
Sure.
In bucket one, you need to have some capability to identify your assets patch level, like what you have. And that's actually something we see people whiff on all the time. So it's really like, you got to know what you need to protect and have some live visibility into it. So that's step one. Step two, which is where I see a lot of the best practices come in, is hardening. Like, so this is IT hygiene. So this is everything from locking down your RMM, multi-factor authentication, regular patching, continuous external vulnerability scanning specifically that reduces your susceptibility to remote code execution. That's a key area. And then the next two areas is where I kind of diverge with industry best practices, kind of in air quotes, because when you look at detection, most all like cyber malicious activity breach detection is so myopically focused on the malicious toolset. And the dirty secret, if you've ever done this game before, is, your malicious tool sets are part of the game, but so much of what you do on the keys looks like clever system administration. You're trying to figure out where you are, you're testing CRIDs, you're port scanning, and that's what we call tradecrafter behavior. And that's where these two worlds need to be merged together. And frankly, there just aren't a lot of people that are good at it out there still, because so much of the dev effort goes towards catching the malicious software. Because I always say, if you ask a software engineer, which I consider the biggest brain guys, to catch a hacker, they're going to try and catch what they would make if they were on the offensive side, which is persistence techniques. This is, kind of exploit techniques, and then just malware in general. If you ask the guy in the keys many times, he's going to be looking for, some amount of dollar sign share, right? All that live off the land, privileged creds, lateral spread. And so I think it's really important that in the tech, you merge those two areas. And then the third part is response. And this is where our industry has kind of bastardized the term a lot. But what it really should mean is real-time response. If you don't have a capability at 2 a.m. to operate with an assume a breach and assume your automated security tools don't succeed, how are you going to take action? And I think that's where the industry's changing, because the typical model was, I get a seam, I gobble up terabytes of logs, I make dashboards, I have threat hunting. Well, that does not work at line rate, period. Like, it just does not work fast enough, but it's great for compliance. It's great for checking the box. It's great for forensics post-breach. And then the last bit is just would be really the write-a-boom, like assuming all went wrong. And you know, that's best practices, cloud backups, you know, having a disaster recovery plan, just making sure you have your kind of insurance and IR folks on speed. You actually know who to call. So I think part of it is like, you know, what capabilities you have in place combined with best practices on hardening.
I'm going to ask you a really targeted one around best practices, because it's one that I feel gets an interesting debate. The head of the UK Cyber Center actually came out recently and sort of commented to, I think most businesses should go to auto patching, because patching is a pretty standardized thing these days. We've got, you know, it's pretty well maintained. These big companies generally know what they're doing. And by the way, because of the problem, like, just turn auto patching on. Most IT providers come from a legacy of thinking like everything has to be tested constantly, checked. Where do you fall on this idea of, particularly for smaller companies like the typical SMB, shouldn't they just turn auto patching on? Isn't that better?
I'm going to have a weird answer. I was a network engineer before I got into hacking. So I have a natural reaction that the IT guys have, which is until my Windows 11 computer can update and not break shit. Think of manufacturers. There's so many industries where a patch takes them down and it can do as much harm as good. I'm a firm believer in continuous vulnerability scanning and a regular patching platform. If I saw a better track record of auto patching not breaking stuff, then maybe I'd support it. But I can tell you, like, we have issues once in a while in our cloud where we run a really modern stack and Amazon might auto patch something for us and it causes us problems. You know, so I think there's just too many moving parts to send it. Now, if you're just talking about like auto Windows update on like a, you know, an attorney's office, it doesn't have manufacturing or, you know, any sort of, you know, kind of weird technologies. Yeah, I think it'd be fine. And I actually think Microsoft is working on some really cool new kind of patching capabilities via their Graph API, if I've heard it right, that are kind of outside of that Windows update. And I think that might open the door for a little more flexibility.
I'll let you split the difference on there, because in fact, when I think of that, I do actually think of that typical small little lawyer. And I just sort of say, like, I think I just turn the thing on automatically.
Yeah, just that one's probably good.
Right.
It's just there's, I mean, when I look at our customer base, I mean, we do large enterprise too, but it is like everything from a tiny 5-person, you know, kind of like property management shop, you know, to a lot of manufacturers, logistics, and people that really will go down hard.
Right. And I think, by the way, this is where the expertise comes in, but it isn't one size fits all. And I am advocating, at least for many network engineers, to go, look, in some of these cases, auto patching is better. Like, it's like there's these use cases at the low end where
I think you're right.
Just make that automatic and don't think about it, because that's the bigger risk for them.
I think so. But you know, also when I look at like what burns most companies, it's funny. If you read the Verizon breach report, it's phishing. Like, we do not see phishing as the number one way you get ransomware. It's the number one way you're going to detect malware, because it's coming in through there all the time. And I think that skews the results. What we still see nonstop, RDP over the internet, a lack of patching on your like network and security appliances. That's a huge area. Running a DMZ, they should be dead. Everyone screws them up. They screw up the rules. It's hard to write the firewall rules right. And inevitably, and then, you know, so really, like, maybe auto patching is on best on anything sitting live on the boundary internet facing. I don't know. I mean, when it comes to the inside, the reality is it's rare that we see exploits thrown inside the network.
Okay.
It's usually a way to get in. I'll tell you, the area I totally believe in auto patching is in the browser.
Okay.
Because, you know, I'm sure hackers would disagree, but my opinion is the holy grail exploit. The one, if you could pick any exploit you want, it's not a firewall exploit because everyone runs a different firewall. It'd be like an Edge, Chrome, or Firefox remote code execution technique. You know, if I can give them an ad or something or whatever, exploit and get access to their system. That is the area that should be just as soon as a new update comes out, roll it, because that has less effects than a system patch, because the system patches just aren't exploited that much inside the network. So I would focus on boundary.
That's some great advice. So I'm going to give one more sort of targeted technical and then move us back into regulation. Yeah. What about the idea of just blocking countries? Like the vast majority of small businesses, like if I think about which are most businesses out there, they're not doing business with a long list of countries that just shouldn't even have access. Like, why aren't the default rules set to just block a whole bunch of countries from even coming in? Would that make more sense?
Yes. Beats the hell out of me why it's not. It should be. It's just by default, period. Now, if someone really wants, it's irrelevant, but it knocks out a certain amount of low-hanging fruit. There's no cost to doing it, and there's really no drawback for not doing it. So I 100% agree with you, Dave. Like, there's no question those should be blocked default. I will caveat that with, we stopped a nation-state attack on one of our non-MSP customers the week of Thanksgiving. And this was definitely in relation to a political move we made as a country. And that night we had guys come in, these guys, this entity was running two next gen AV EDRs in addition to us. And the bad guys evaded both of those, no problem, not a single alert, but they used residential proxy infrastructure in the US to come through the United States to hide their tracks. So in, the SolarWinds stuff did that too. And any legit operator will do that. So it's not a cure-all, but it's a definite do it.
And that's what I'm getting is just the like, hey, if we can reduce our tax services,
you're right.
Let's do the simple things, knowing, again, for the typical small, mid-sized company, like they're not going to win against a nation state. So
all day long.
so let's just do that with stuff.
Yeah.
Let me pivot then a little bit to sort of regulation and the landscape. What's your take on the need for sort of more formal rules of engagement around cyber, like similar to the Geneva Convention or international laws on physical warfare, because it feels like we don't have even law enforcement or diplomatic rules to latch onto here. What's your take on the need for these formal rules?
That is a loaded question. So first off, I don't believe any international norms, diplomatic engagement when a country or nation state is desperate enough that they don't care. I think we're seeing that in Ukraine right this second. Right? Cluster munitions, use them like crazy. White phosphorus, using them. So I don't think that actually really moves the needle. I think that feels good. I'll tell you the area where I think we need a lot more focus is step one. I think we need... Everyone creates a compliance framework. And when I read these, half the compliance frameworks out there, they're written clearly from someone that was never an offensive practitioner or even a hardcore defensive. And they're written all post-breach lessons learned. Like, you must have these logs so you can figure out what data was stolen. But at the end of the day, these things should be increasing your capacity to not get breached in the first place. Or if you do, nullify it before the adversary completes their objectives. So this is why I'm a huge fan of CISs, kind of benchmarks and controls. Because they're actually prescriptive. They tell you to configure the following settings to reduce your attack surface. And so, whether it's by regulation or the market drives it, right? I think this is something where, MSP should really be looking to adopt it, because honestly, it's just smart business. Anything you can do to reduce your chances as an MSP owner from your customer getting smashed and then blaming you, which hurts your insurance and your whole business model, I would do it. I'll tell you the other area, and others might not agree with me, that I think needs some tightening up. We have an insurance agency, right? We had to get licensed and fingerprinted in all 50 states to resell someone else's insurance policy. Yet I can go write an exploit proof of concept code, throw it up on GitHub, and get all the congratulations from the security community. No license, no regulation. People will do bug bounties. And one of the scariest things, I agree, we need bug bounty stuff. But one of the things that always makes me nervous is when you have kind of vigilante entities out there that are kind of doing pen testing without your request, which we all know to kind of like do it well. So you got to cross that line sometimes and actually execute code. When they do that, and like, oh my gosh, we have something bad, they call the company. Then they make scanners that tries to find other vulnerable victims. Well, to think that nation states are not looking and have honeypots out there looking for these people with new exploit techniques, you're crazy. They are. And that's a great way, in the interest of security, to actually let the cat out of the bag. And then it takes a step further. So now you're arming like maybe more competent and capable adversaries with your great new research findings. And then you call the company and then you CVE them when maybe there was no user involvement required. I think it's ethically corrupt and I think it's not good for security, because if you can close a problem, there's no impact, no harm, it hasn't been taken advantage of, you're still operating as a defender with a bit of an information asymmetry advantage, or that vendor. When you make it public, how many variant follow-ons? I mean, we all saw, like, you know, the exchange thing had multiple, once the community found out about it, you start seeing follow-on exploits. And so that's why I think it's nuance matters, details matters, and we have to balance transparency with actually doing and what's right for the end customer and vendor to keep the infrastructure secure, so that it isn't all about just getting, you know, kind of resume builders, you know, for the security research community, because I think they play an incredibly legit role. But there's no security industry I've ever seen in the world where utter, complete, 100% transparency.
All right, you've opened the door. You've opened the door. So my follow-on question is obvious. My follow-on question is obvious. What's your take on what a vulnerability disclosure program should be? Like, what's the way that it should work for software vendors?
In my opinion, if there is a vulnerability that requires end user involvement, like the IT guy, the end customer, to apply a patch because it cannot be pushed out, you have to shout that from the rooftops. That has to be public and it has to be everywhere. If you have a capability that that was brought to you, there's no evidence it was ever exploited, it was never known about a criminal group, I personally think the act of writing about that is doing nothing but educating your adversaries on a potential weakness. And if it was covered up, I think I think everyone should keep their mouth shut. I also think a formal bug bounty program, you know, where you can work with the researchers is really good. I would love to see for the MSP vendor community an ISO ISAC concept where the vendors that care step up and sign an MOU and say, we commit to regular application pen testing. If there's a vulnerability that it's like, we can't fix this fast enough, but other security vendors can cover it, maybe we have a private closed door way to share that stuff, you know, with some government involvement so that we can be more prepared. So again, nuance there, but I think that would be, that's my personal opinion, but it's totally up for debate, to be clear, because not everyone's going to agree with me. I've seen it from both sides. And this is my honest, just pragmatic take on what I think is
the best. I've been focused on this area, so that's why I asked the question. So if vulnerability disclosure is the front end, let me ask then, what's your take on breach disclosure, which is essentially the back end of that? What's your take on breach disclosure notifications?
Oh, I think that's a legal issue, and I think you absolutely have to do it. And each state has different rules on it, first off. That is something like, you kind of judge people on what they do and no one's looking, right? And I think this is a perfect case. If you sweep it under the rug, that's an unethical move. You need to inform your customers. I would say the definition of breach is also, you know, maybe there's a legal definition for it, but you know, we stop stuff every day. Bad guy's in network. He's gone nowhere. He's snuffed out. Done. Should a vendor disclose that to the world? I don't know. I don't think that like does anything for anyone but create like concern or panic. If part of their code base was stolen, if their customer data was stolen, unequivocally, you have to.
So I'm going to ask it a different way then. If I gave you the magic wand and you could cast a federal piece of regulation around breach disclosure, what would your version look like?
I think my version would start with a definition of what we consider a breach. So kind of along the lines of what I was just saying. Loss of customer data, loss of PII, you know, loss of like source code or something that could enable follow-on attacks, or something that actually disrupted operations. That was a malicious thing that disrupted operations and maybe left you not serviced at that point in time. You know, I think that's something where there should be a requirement to disclose to your customer base and a requirement to disclose to the appropriate government agency.
Gotcha. Well, John, you've given a ton of information today. I understand you guys have launched a new podcast. What are you up to with that?
Yeah. It's called The Unfair Fight. And really, you know, this is a podcast we're really excited to do. We just filmed our first episode last week, and we just want to shine a light on kind of three main areas. Like, one is going to be a tech track, right? We're going to look at malware trends. And frankly, this is just a way to keep our customer base and the MSPs up to speed on the latest and greatest stuff so that they can better defend themselves, right? The middle tier is more on really how to run high performance orgs. This is geared at, this is geared at owners of MSPs, owner operators, you know, prospective owners or founders. And it's all really lessons learned from other industries and then some successful like yourself in the MSP game that have been there and done that. And then the last one is just an ingredient we have because of our background, where we're kind of bringing pretty notable, generally former national security types that are very high up, play the game at the highest level, to kind of take a step back and look at when we see issues from like the intersection of geopolitics, national security, they have cyber impacts, like the Russia-Ukraine thing potentially. Or if you look what's going on, like there's stuff going on between Israel and Iran right now. Like there's a massive DDoS attack last week, shining a light on that at the big picture. So we can kind of put it in context down market. Is this, hey, nice to know, we're informed. But, you know, the game has several levels to it. And so I wanted to shine a light on that upper level that I don't think a lot of the MSP community gets exposed to.
Very cool. And the name of the podcast again?
The Unfair Fight.
Awesome. Well, John, thanks for joining me today.
Dave, that was awesome. I appreciate everything you do for the community. Giving back after running an MSP is huge. It's huge. Really appreciate it.
Remember, if you like this kind of content, you can support it directly. Visit patreon.com/MSP Radio for our Give What You Want program. Every little bit helps, and we are supported directly by listeners like you. The Business of Tech is written and produced by me, Dave Sobel, under ethics guidelines posted at businessof.tech. Like the content? Support the show at patreon.com/MSP Radio. Or buy our Why Do We Care merch at businessof.tech. If you want to reach our listeners, visit mspradio.com/engage.
Part of the MSP Radio Network.